Session number 8985, Reel 1.
Mr. Parry, Reel 1. Where were you born, Mr. Parry?
Dartford, Kent, on the 29th of October, 1915.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was, I think I've been right to say, the number two in the London County Council in their hospitals department. He originally was the assistant clerk to the board of the Metropolitan Asylums Board, and they were swallowed up by the LCC, and then I think he got the sort of number two admin job to Sir Frederick Menges, I think, at that time.
Where were you educated?
Dartford Grammar School.
So how old were you when you left?
17.
To do what?
I was then articled to a surveyor called Henry H. Prawl. The firm was called Prawl & Prawl, 53 Spittle Street, Dartford in Kent. And I served 3 years articles with them, and 1 year as an improver, and then I immigrated to South Africa.
What made you decide to do that?
I didn't know what to do, and my father virtually decided it for me, which is, I think, probably often the case. And I liked the idea of an outdoor life, so I was very pleased to do it, and I've never been sorry.
So, were you in South Africa when war was declared?
No, I was in Northern Rhodesia then. What had happened, I spent 3 months in Johannesburg with an uncle that I had there, who was the chief accountant for the Shell Company. In fact, he set up the Shell Company in South Africa in 1927. They had agents before that, but he was a chartered accountant, and he set it up in Cape Town, Bloemfontein, and Johannesburg, and remained out there as chief accountant. And one's got to be quite honest about this. I made a mess up of my surveyor's exams, and I was filling in the dumps, and my father happened to be quite a brilliant scholar. And there was a sort of a bit of an argument, and I wrote to this uncle and said, look, can you find me a job? And that's how I got out there. And after about 3 months, he had a friend who was one of the consulting engineers for the Anglo-American Mining Corporation. And he asked me what I did for a living. So I said, I'm a surveyor. And he said, well, why aren't you working? I said, because I can't find a job. And he said, well, there are plenty of jobs going on the mine. And you go down to Springs Mines tomorrow, and I'll see that you're fixed up with a job. I don't really need to, I think, to go into that in detail, except to say that I was transferred from a mine called Sally's South African Land Exploration Company, where I found there had been a major mistake made in the new plant which was being built. And, of course, all steel work and stuff in those days came from the UK. There were no steel works in South Africa at all. So, fortunately, a lot of it, sort of gantries and conveyors between one bit and the other, was able to be amended before it was shipped out to South Africa. And they were very kind. They said what a fine chap I was, and gave me an increase of £5 a month from, I think it was £20 a month, £25 a month, which I know it sounds mad, but I used to have money in those days. And a little while afterwards, they said they had a project going. They'd just taken over a mine in Northern Rhodesia, the Rhodesia Hill, the Rhodesia Broken Hill Development Company, and they wanted someone to go and do the construction survey plus the mine survey up there. And after a deal of haggling, I went. After about a year, I say almost exactly, I used to play a reasonable game of tennis in those days, and I got into some club final for the whole of Northern Rhodesia. And one of the umpires happened to be the chief surveyor of Mufulira mine. And he said, look, why don't you come up and join us? So I said, well, what kind of salary are you offering? So he told me £45 a month, and I think at that time I was probably getting about 35. So after a few months I did in fact go and join them as a professional tennis player. I mean, not really, but you know, it was to help there. So they had five good men, but they wanted a sixth, and they considered I was good enough. So I went to Mufulira, and we had the usual pre-war scares of, I think it was a September 38, March 39, and then the real thing came up. And another chap called Alan, his full name Alan John Frederick, hyphenated Alan White, he and I left on the 24th of September, if I remember rightly, and having waged a campaign against the mine and the Northern Rhodesia government to let us get out of the copper mining industry, one said, we will release you provided the government will let you go. And he went to them and they said, well, we'll let you go if the mine will agree to you going. So it was a chicken and egg situation.
Let you go to do what?
To come join up. We wanted to come and come over and join up. And eventually, after about 3 weeks, a chap who was in fact coming over, a fellow called Bob Worthington, who was killed in North Africa or the Western Desert in the Air Force, actually at that time was on his way over to England to go to the Camborne School of Mines, and he decided that he wouldn't do so, and he came back and they said, all right, well, we'll accept him as being one surveyor and against you two, and now you two can go. So we got down to Durban, where Alan White, who was a South African, where his mother was, and we spent a bit of time there. We were going to come home on the Carnarvon Castle. But the Carnarvon Castle didn't get past Cape Town. They turned her into a so-called armed merchant cruiser. So we sat in Durban until, I think it was actually my birthday, it's the 29th of October, when the Durban Castle came through. I always remember this because they said she was now going to carry the mail, so they put the fares up by 10%, which is rather amusing, really. We were going to pay about £33, and it went up to 36 or something. I know these figures are absurd, but that's what it was in those days. And when we got round to Cape Town, they put a gun on the back. It took quite a while. And that's where I met a Commander Robertson, who, strange enough, was Annan Eagle's brother. And he and a naval type used to sit there and watch them putting this anti-aircraft gun on. It was a pop gun, really, I suppose. Eventually we left, and via Freetown we came to UK. The only thing you can say as possible adventure on that was that we did a dirty turn to the left, I suppose better say port side, and everything nearly shook to pieces, and we understood afterwards that we had just missed the Graf's Bay, who was busy sinking, I think it was one of the Clan Line things. Anyway, it was a cargo boat, one of the well-known lines. I think it was Clan. Anyway, we never saw anything. and got back to England on the, I think it was the 26th of November, 39.
Could I ask you at this stage why it was that you were so keen to join up?
Well, it's an old-fashioned word, I suppose. Patriotism. I don't think adventure. I don't know. It's hard to say. There was no doubt in my mind that it was going to be a bad do. I suppose the idea was of flying, too. I mean, what I knew about flying was nothing, nothing whatever. But I really can't give you a better answer than to say that we just, this was a South African too that came with me, we just wanted to come, that's all. Perhaps patriotism's a wrong word, perhaps it was just adventure, and I don't know, at that age you can...
So you'd gone with the intention of joining the RAF?
Yes.
And had you had in mind any particular branch of the RAF that you wanted to go into?
Just to fly, that's all. Just to be a pilot. Nothing else. I mean, I obviously would have accepted a navigator's job if I couldn't have been a pilot. There is a mild story attached to that, that on the boat, amongst other people, there were only 47 of us, I think, in the tourist class and three in the first class, and we were not allowed to mix or use their swimming pool or anything like that. The captain wouldn't let us do that. And... But on there was a man called Jack Bowie, who we got quite friendly with, much a deal older than we were. I mean, I don't know how old he would have been, perhaps, I don't know, maybe 50 then, I don't know. He was old to us anyway. And he said, look, if in London, you're going to Rhodesia House. And we said, well, we don't know. We're going to South Africa House to start with to see if we can, you know, get in the Air Force, because it might be difficult. And if we'd had no luck with them, we'd go to Rhodesia House. Well, he said, look, if you come across Colonel Meredith, I know he's in London, tell him that Jack Bowie is over, and... I can be contacted at Barclays Bank DCO there in Cockspur Street. They'd leave a message there for me and I'll pick it up. I'd like to see him again because we're old friends. Well, when we went to South Africa House, we had no luck. They didn't want to know our troubles. They said, oh, there are lots of South Africans over here wanting to do the same thing, and there's a 9 months delay. You haven't got a chance. So we then went along to Rhodesia House, 329 The Strand, and a very much smaller and very much more friendly place. And in fact, we had come from northern Rhodesia, albeit not southern Rhodesia, which is really what Rhodesia House represented, of course. But we had no trouble in seeing originally a man who'd been the Rhodesian 100 yards champion. I remember his name, Tiki Abbott, I think he was called. Doesn't really matter, but he put us through to the High Commissioner, who had an Irish name, I suppose. In fact, he was born Irish, Lanigan O'Keefe. And it was a small place, and you could get in to see these sort of people, you see. And he said he didn't know what he could do about it. It was difficult, and... But, you know, he would see what he could do. And then in the course of conversation, he says, as a matter of fact, I do have a Colonel Meredith in the building at the moment. He's come over here to organise a big training scheme in Rhodesia and South Africa. And so I said, perhaps... Oh, Colonel Meredith, a great friend of a friend of his, which was stretching it a little, but he said, oh, well, that's fine, you come along and see him, he'll have much more pull than I would, and he took us along, and I think he went in first and spoke to Meredith. When we came in anyway, Meredith simply said, I understand you're a friend of Jack Bowie, so we just passed on this message and so forth, and... He said, I hear you want to join the Air Force. And both of us said, yes, we did. Well, he said, look, I can't promise you a commission. All that's gone now. But I think get you in all right, provided you pass the physical. Hang on. And he rang up a man at the Air Ministry called Group Captain Grodon. That was spelled G-R-O-W-D-O-N. In retrospect, it's funny, we didn't even know what a group captain was. I mean, to us, it probably meant just like a captain, really, and perhaps in charge of a group or something, which I suppose it is, but in a rather a different way. So we went down to the actual Air Ministry and went into this very large, comfortable office where there was a huge desk with rather a small gentleman in civilian clothes sitting behind it. Again, we didn't understand that these sort of people didn't wear uniforms as a normal course of events. They were always civilians in civilian dress anyway. And we saw him, and he said, all right, well, provided you can pass the physical, where are you staying? So I said, well, my people live in Dartford in Kent, and we'll be staying there. So he looked up something, and he said, well, there's a pub called the Yorkshire Grey at Eltham. And he said, they've taken over the club room, ballroom, whatever you like to call it, the back, for preliminary medical examinations. And you go and see them. And then we'll take it from there. So we did. And we both got through all of that all right. And then from there we were sent to Victory House in Kingsway, quite close to Adastral House, but it was on the right hand side going up the Kingsway. And I don't remember the name of who we saw there. It was a wing commander of some, and he told us to report to Uxbridge and go before a selection board there, which we did. And passed that all right. Then we had a very much harder medical where they really saw that your eyes were 6-6 and the rest of it. I mean, you had to have perfect eyesight at that time. Later on in the war, they dropped it a little, but at that time it was 6-6. So they said, all right, I can't remember whether done by letter or done on the spot. We got, incidentally, we joined the Air Force quickly on December the 2nd, 1930. It didn't take long, but it was, I think it must have been pretty well on the spot, and we were told to report to Uxbridge, where we were put into a block called Mons Block.
Could I stop you there?
Yes.
And ask you, what branch did you, what were your duties in the RAF?
Well, pilot, we got in as pilots, both of us, and we both went to through the usual training, number one. I don't know what I wrote to you, whether I only gave you squadrons or not, but we went to number one elementary flying training school at Hatfield, which is de Havilland's thing there, and did whatever the elementary training there, and then there's a thing which I might have written, number 10 at Yatesbury, and I might have written down there, pre-fighter course. That was true, but it was actually guff, really, because I think they hadn't got room to put you into the service flying training schools at that time. And so it was a stopgap, about 2 weeks. As a matter of interest, I saw a thing I've never seen before or since. A very strong wind blowing, and this place at Yatesbury was Bristol Aircraft Company, one of their drones. And an instructor went up in a Tiger Moth with this very strong wind. They were all Tiger Moths there. And he got off, he went up, I don't know, 500 feet. And then he went backwards across the drone because a Tiger stalled at about 45 miles an hour, and I suppose there was a 60-65 mile an hour wind, and it looked ridiculous to see this plane just going backwards across the aerodrome. Much of interest at aerodrome's entirely gone now. I go past it fairly regularly because, as you know, I live in Wiltshire, and coming up for Carn and so forth, I often see it, and I suppose some of it's been taken over as farm buildings. Just there, too, was the biggest wireless place in Britain, I think, at Jadesbury. I couldn't believe it. Everything's gone. There is just one building, and you can just... I haven't got out to look, but driving along, you can see a little bit of tarmac. It must have been a road at one time. It's just gone back to farmland, which is good. But
did you want to fly in fighters or bombers?
Fighters. I think everybody really did.
For what reason?
I suppose we'd all read about the Red Baron and... well, all the big aces, Ball and McCudden, and all these, they're much more glamorous than driving a bus sort of idea, really. I mean, it's... I wouldn't like to be a bomber pilot. I mean, I changed my views on that altogether. I think they were incredibly brave people. I mean that, really. Fighters, it was... And, you know, you had a... comfortable base to get back to, as long as you didn't get knocked off, you were all right. I mean, and whereas they sat in these things for hours, hours and hours under terrible conditions, and you had to have the right mentality for that, I'm afraid. I suppose I would have been the same.
Terrible conditions from the point of view of enemy attack, you mean?
Yes, and cold, you know. I mean, they flew fairly high, and I mean, there was, unlike the Americans who carried all mod cons with heated flying suits and all that sort of thing, but then they had also probably 13 men that sat in a fortress. Let's face it, their bomb load was about 3,000 pounds. Whereas a Mosquito used to take a blockbuster, a 4,000-pounder, it was very unstable, but it still did it. I mean, when it went off the ground, it used to yawl over the place. Once they got up, it did take a 4,000-pound bomb.
Was it easy for you to become a fighter pilot, personally? To be selected?
Yeah, well... I don't know how. I mean, all my things were average. I didn't get any above averages or below averages. I was just an average pilot. They graded you exceptional, above average, average, below average. They were the grades. And I suppose most people got average, which is why it was average, I suppose. I'm just trying to think where they must have made their selection. You had to, of course, take ground exams as well, you know, navigation, and they had to take guns to pieces and put them together again, and meteorological stuff, all that sort of thing. And I know that what they did at that time, at the time I passed at Kidlington, they commissioned the top third. The rest were sergeant pilots. But how they decided on where you would go from there or not, I don't know. But I went to number 55, I think was the number, 55 OTU at Aston Down near Stroud.
Now, jumping ahead in the war to Malta... Can you tell me how you got your posting to Malta?
Yes, it was a very unfortunate experience in actual fact. I had been, this chap that I came over with, this Alan White, he had been killed on the 11th of January 1942. 35 miles off Cromer. He was on the tail of a JU-88. Weather conditions were very bad. And he was supposed to be by the RT conversation. Also, we had a Y service, I think it was called, which listened out to the German radio transmissions. And this JU-88 said that it was being attacked by two Spitfires, and one was firing at it, and it escaped into cloud. Now, the cloud base, according to the chap that came back out of the two, was about 300 feet, and weather conditions were bad, and you know, in those conditions, there's no horizon at all. The difference between the sea and cloud is no, well, no, it's really, well, they merge. There's no line or anything. And what is thought to have happened is that he was obviously closing on this thing and was pretty close, and it's thought that he hit the slipstream of this thing, which tilted him one way or another. I'd have turned him right over, but it would have certainly, if he did get into the slipstream, it could easily have turned him over. And he never recovered, but we shall never know that, because the other chap didn't see it, and all they found afterwards was oil in the sea, and I think they saw an oxygen bottle or something like that, but that was that. Well, some time after that, we moved down from, this time we were at one of the Wittering satellites, and Kingscliff, actually, it had several names. Once it was called WB2, and then it was called K2, but it was a Wittering satellite anyway. And we moved down to Duxford, which you'll know is near Cambridge, and became what's the word I'm thinking about, converted to Typhoons. We were the second squadron in the Air Force to get Typhoons. I can never remember whether it was 54 or 56 that got the first lot. They were also at Duxford. They were at, I think the satellite of Duxford was Warmwell. And they were there. I don't ever remember having anything to do with them. I was only there in that fact short time. And then something went wrong with me. A blessed finger went all rotten. And they did a couple of small jobs on it in the sick bay. And the next thing I knew, I'd been sent down to what do they call the thing? The Palace Hotel in Torquay, which had been taken over as an RAF hospital. It was run just like you would say an RAF mess. The only difference was that the reception area, you had a WAF behind the desk instead of a civilian. They had their bar going, whereas if the doctor thought it was all right, you could get either, fun enough, Madeira or beer, nothing else. It's the Madeira that amused me even then. Anyway, that was the story. And I had a phone call from my CO, who finished up the war as he's dead now, actually, Charles Green. He finished up as a group captain with a DSO and a DFC and bar. And at that time, he was undecorated. He was a Rhodesian. He'd come from Coastal Command to take over us, really, when we became the Rhodesia Squadron. It was the idea. He was a flight commander for a short while, and then the CO of that time was Barney Beresford, wing commander, no, sorry, he finished up as Air Commodore T.B. de la Pour Beresford. Marvellous chap, anyway. He was shipped off to the Middle East, given a wing commander's job, and Charles took over. And he rang me up and said, look, when are you coming back? So I said, well, I was about to ring you to tell you I'll be back tomorrow or the day after to Duxford, you see. And he said, well, you better, because group are going mad, because we don't have a B-flight.